be none other than Marc Laurent.
Monsieur Gentry, I presume.
Court said nothing. The little man with the notepad on Laurent's right stepped forward and kicked him with an expensive-looking shoe. Court did not feel the blow. His entire body had gone numb.
When Monsieur Laurent asks you a question, you answer. It's okay, Pierre. He's unwell.
Laurent looked around him at the bodies and broken glass and smoke billowing from the roof of the chateau.
Pierre, make a note. We'll need to move the board of directors' Christmas retreat this year. I don't believe we will have the property cleaned up in time. Oui, Monsieur Laurent. Mr. Gentry, I see young Mr. Lloyd there. He appears to be about as useful as ever. Would you happen to know where I could find Herr Riegel?
Court spoke softly, sleepily.
Lloyd killed him. He killed Lloyd. There was some interdepartmental rivalry in your corporation shortly before you arrived. I see.
Laurent shrugged, as if his people died all the time, and it was of no special concern to him.
I knew nothing of what was going on here, said Laurent,
and Gentry did not respond. The statement was made in the way a man in power says something manifestly untrue. He had no concern whether the gray man believed him or not, only that it was put out there, as if to fulfill legal obligations. Implausible deniability. The next words from Laurent's mouth surprised Court.
I am in need of a man.
He looked around at the bright morning.
It's a problem, you see. A fellow with whom I've had a long-standing business relationship has outlived his usefulness, and if that wasn't bad enough, he's in possession of information that might prove embarrassing to myself and my pursuits. Allowing him to continue on in his present course of action would serve no one's interests.
Marc Laurent seemed almost bored. He looked at the fresh manicure of his fingernails.
And, as it happens, I understand you are the man to see about such problems. Might you be available?
Court was up on his elbows in the wet grass. He turned his head to the left and to the right and took a moment to regard Lloyd's body. Gentry said,
I am kind of in the middle of something at the moment.
Laurent waved his hand dismissively.
Oh, I can see to that. That would be good.
Court replied with extreme understatement.
And as I understand it, you might just have a personal interest in the demise of former president and now regular citizen Julius Abubakar. Rumor is you eliminated his brother, and now the former president is arranging attempts on your life.
Court blinked twice before answering.
I've heard that rumor as well, Mr. Laurent.
Laurent nodded.
Abubakar has made certain claims about me, all lies, of course. I run a business based on integrity and impeccable core values of honesty.
Gentry's facial expression did not change.
No doubt. Still, sometimes sensational claims can take on a life of their own, raise unnecessary concerns, invite uncomfortable scrutiny. I'd like to avoid that if possible.
So you want me to kill him?
Laurent nodded.
I'd pay handsomely for your services.
Court hesitated.
I just see one little problem with your proposal.
The Frenchman's eyebrows rose.
And what would that be? I am bleeding to death.
Laurent chuckled, snapped his fingers, and the three men in orange jackets appeared with a stretcher.
No problem, young man, said Laurent,
as Court dropped from his elbows and passed out. He relived the conversation in a dream and thought it later to be one of the oddest and most fanciful dreams he'd ever had. Epilogue. There were only 4 days left until the Christmas break, and Mummy had told the girls they could wait until after the New Year to return to school. Kate had taken Mummy up on the offer, but Claire declined. Routine is important for a child. She wanted to get back into the swing of things. Maybe it would help her forget. She would love to forget Daddy's funeral, the chateau in France, the noise and the fear and the guns and the blood. She would love to forget leaving Mr. Jim behind. Grandpa Donald had promised her that Jim had gotten away, but she did not believe a thing Grandpa Donald told her anymore. She knew that Jim, like Daddy, was dead. She entered Hyde Park. She always cut through on her way to school, walked purposefully east on North Carriage Drive, turned down a footpath that led over to North Row, and then shortly to her school on North Audrey Street. Her mummy wanted to walk her to school, but Claire had said no. She wanted everything to be the same as when Daddy was around. She'd walk herself to school, walk herself home. A man sat on a bench by the footpath. She paid him no attention until he called her name as she passed. "Hello, Claire." She stopped in her tracks and turned to face Jim. Her knees weakened from shock, and she dropped her school books to the footpath. "I didn't mean to scare you. Your granddad told me you did not believe that I was okay. I just wanted to come and show you that I'm fine." She hugged him, her mind not quite accepting that he was there.
You were awfully hurt. Are you feeling better?"
she asked in a sob of joy. "I'm all better." He stood and smiled and took a few steps up the pavement and then back to her. "See, I don't even need you to help me walk anymore." Claire laughed and hugged him again. Tears filled her eyes.
"You must come to the house straight away. Mommy would so love to see you. She doesn't even remember you being there in France."
Jim shook his head. "I'm sorry, I have to go. I only have a few minutes." She frowned.
"Are you still working for my grandpa?"
Jim looked off into the distance. "I'm working for someone else right now. Maybe Don and I will patch things up someday."
"Jim?"
She sat down on the bench, and he followed her lead.
"The people who killed my father. You killed them, right?"
"They won't hurt anyone else, Claire, I promise."
"That's not what I asked. Did you kill them?"
"Many people died, good and bad, but that is all over now. That's all I can really tell you. I can't help you make sense of it all. Maybe someone else can. I hope so, but not me. I'm sorry." Claire looked across the park.
"I'm glad Grandpa Donald wasn't lying about you."
"Me too." It was quiet for a moment. Jim began to shuffle a little on the bench. Claire said,
"You have to go now, right?"
"I'm sorry. I have to catch a plane."
"That's okay. I have to go to school. Routine is important."
"Yeah." He paused. "I guess it is." They both stood, hugged again. "Take care of your sister and your mother, Claire. You're a strong girl. You will be fine."
"I know, Jim. Merry Christmas," she said to him,
and then they both said goodbye. Court walked slowly out of the park and onto Upper Grosvenor Square. The limp he had managed to hide from Claire had returned, and he winced with each step. A black Peugeot sedan idled just outside the gate. He ducked into the back seat without a word to the occupants. Two Frenchmen in suits turned to face him from the front. One handed him a satchel as the car pulled into traffic. Quietly, Court opened it, checked its contents, and zipped it shut. The middle-aged Frenchman in the passenger seat said,
"The jet is waiting at Stansted. 3 hours flying time. You should be in Madrid by early afternoon."
Court did not respond. He only looked out the window.
"Abu Bakr will arrive at his hotel at 6. Are you sure you have enough time to prepare?"
Still nothing from the American.
"We have arranged their room on the floor directly below his suite."
Gentry just stared at the park as it passed. Children walked with their parents. lovers arm in arm. The Frenchman in the passenger seat rudely snapped his fingers in front of Gentry's face, as if admonishing an inattentive servant.
Monsieur, are you listening?
The gray man turned slowly to the man. His eyes were clearer now.
Understood. No problem. Plenty of time.
The older Frenchman barked.
I don't need you fucking this up.
And I don't need your advice. It's my show. I call the time and location.
You are my property, monsieur. We have spent a lot of money on your recovery. You will do as you are told.
Court wanted to protest, wanted to reach into the front seat and break the passenger's neck, but he checked his urges. Kurt Riegel's successor was a bigger asshole than Kurt Riegel, but he was also Gentry's boss. If only for the time being.
Yes, sir,
said Court, though he wanted to say more. He turned his head back to the window, caught a final glimpse of the southern tip of the park, the lovers and the children, and the families and the lives of others so incredibly different from his own. The Peugeot turned left on Piccadilly, left the park behind, and melted into the heavy traffic of London's morning commute.
This has been an Audible Inc. presentation of The Gray Man, written by Mark Greeny, narrated by Jay Snyder. Executive producer, Steve Feldberg. Producer, Mike Charzik. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2009, Mark Strode Greeny. Production copyright 2010 by Audible Inc.
And now a free preview of On Target, Book 2 in the Gray Man series.
Prologue. Dark clouds hung low above the Irish Sea, fat in the moist morning air, and tracked slowly over the assassin as he stood on the wooden foredeck of the fishing boat. A few screeching herring gulls had encircled the vessel while it was still miles offshore. Now that it had entered the harbor channel, a flock 12 strong swarmed above and around, churning the mist with their white wings. The seabirds shrieked at the vessel, bleated warnings to the Irish coast of the arrival of a killer to its shores. But their warnings were lost in the vapor. The boat docked in its harbor slip just before 8 a.m., The assassin climbed off the deck and onto the quay without a glance at the two crew members. Not a single word had been exchanged in the 3 hours since the 40-foot Lochan had picked its passenger up from a Lithuanian freighter in international waters. He remained on the deck, moving fore and aft, vigilantly scanning the roiling sea around him, his black hooded raincoat protecting him from the salty spray and the occasional shower, as well as the curious eyes of the father and son who operated the boat. The crew remained in the wheelhouse during the journey, following strict instructions. They had been told to pick up a passenger and then keep away from him, to return him to Howth Harbor just north of Dublin. After delivering this odd catch of the day, they were to enjoy their payment and hold their bloody tongues. The assassin walked through the seaside village to the tiny train depot and bought a ticket to Connolly Station in central Dublin. With half an hour to kill, he stepped down the station steps and into the basement pub. The bloody scream served a full Irish breakfast for the fishermen in the harbor. The long, narrow room was more than half full of men wolfing down plates of eggs and sausage and baked beans, washing it all down with pints of ink-dark, foamy Guinness stout. The assassin knew how to assimilate in unfamiliar surroundings. He grunted and gestured to hide his foreign accent and ordered the same as those around him. He dug into his plate and drained his beer before leaving the bloody scream to catch his train. A half hour later, he trudged through Dublin. He wore his brown beard thick and a blue watch cap down over his ears and forehead, a scarf tight around his neck, and a dark blue peacoat into which his gloved hands dug deep to hide from the frigid air. Hanging over a shoulder, a small canvas bag swung with his footsteps. He headed south, away from the train station, then turned right at the quay of the River Liffey and followed it as chilled rain began to fall. The assassin walked on. He looked forward to getting this errand behind him. He had not been comfortable at sea, nor was he comfortable now in the morning crowd growing around him as he neared O'Connell Street. But there was a man here in Dublin who, it had been decided by someone with money and influence, should cease to exist. And court gentry had come to see to that. Chapter 1. At a pharmacy, he bought a pack of acetaminophen tablets and a bottled water. He'd been injured a few months back, a bullet through the thigh and a knife blade into his gut. The pain had lessened by the week. The body had incredible power to heal, so much greater than that of the mind. Cort had grown dependent on the pills and injections, Vicodin and Oxycontin, Demerol and Dilaudid. A surgeon in Nice had kept him supplied since the operation to clean and close his abdominal wound, and Gentry had popped pills each day since. But he'd purposely left them behind when he boarded the freighter. He'd gone over a week now without his meds, and this self-imposed detox was making him miserable. The acetaminophen was no substitute for a heavy narcotic, but his mind found comfort in the ritual of swallowing the tablets nonetheless. 3 hours after leaving the boat, he checked into a Chinese-run budget hotel in a narrow alley off Parnell Street, a half-mile north of the river. His room was dark and dank and smelled of mold and frying grease. The restaurant 2 floors below him blew the stench through the vents. A near-horizontal rain beat steadily on the dirty window but failed to clean it. The oily grime covered the inside of the glass. Gentry lay on his back on the sagging mattress and stared at the ceiling, his thoughts unfocused. He'd been on a boat for over a week. It felt odd not swaying back and forth, rising slowly up and down. It took hours to drift to sleep, the cold rain unceasing on the pane next to his head. In the mid-afternoon, he sat at the Chinese restaurant in the tiny hotel, ate noodles and pork, and used a store-bought mobile phone to log onto the internet. He accessed a bulletin board on a website that sold adventure tours of the Ural Mountains, entered a password to log onto a forum for employees. With a further code, he gained entry to a thread with one other viewer. Cort typed on his phone with his thumb while he drank tepid orange juice. "I'm here." A few seconds later, the tiny window in the phone refreshed. Someone had replied on the forum. "In Bangkok, I trust." This was the code that confirmed the identity of the other party. Gentry's identity was established with his reply. "No, Singapore." Only by the misspelling was the identity check complete. "Nice journey, my friend," came the next reply. Cort read it, bit into a fried wonton as greasy as the window in his upstairs room. He tried not to roll his eyes. It had not been a nice journey, and Gregor Ivanovich Sidorenko was not Cort Gentry's friend. Cort had no friends, and it was unlikely Sidorenko, or Sid, to all those in the West who knew of him, had any himself. He was Russian mob, an overboss in St. Petersburg. He ran an organization that controlled illegal gambling and drugs and hookers and hitmen, and, out of desperation on the part of the American assassin, he now ran Cort Gentry, the Gray Man. While ostensibly in the same line of work, Gregor Sidorenko was no Donald Fitzroy. Sir Donald had been Cort's handler for years, ever since the CIA had chased Gentry out of the U.S. with a burn notice and a shoot-on-sight directive. Fitzroy had taken him in, had offered him good jobs against bad men, had paid him fairly for his work, and had even once hired him to protect his own family. But then Fitzroy had been pushed into a corner, had turned on Cort, and though he'd apologized profusely and even offered up his life to his American employee in recompense, Gentry knew he could never trust him again. He would never trust anyone again. Sid was scum, but he was a known quantity. Cort knew he couldn't trust the forked-tongued Russian fuck as far as he could throw him, but Sid could supply access to some of the most lucrative contracts in the industry. And Sid agreed to Gentry's caveat that he would only accept those hits he deemed righteous, or at least those that tipped slightly to the good side of the morally neutral category, which had led Court here to Ireland. This trip to Dublin was Court's first stop for Sid. He'd read the dossier of the target, agreed to the job, argued online about the low wages offered for the contract, and then reluctantly accepted. He needed to stay operational. The downtime and the wounds and the drugs were softening him, and he was a man who absolutely could not afford to soften. Court had memorized the relevant portions of the target's dossier, standard operating procedure before a wet operation. Name, Dougal Slattery. Age, 54 years. Nationality, Irish. Height, big. Weight, fat. He'd been a boxer as a young man, but couldn't break out of the thick mid-list of the local pugilistic talent. Then he found work as a tough guy, a bouncer in Dublin nightclubs. He branched out, did some rough stuff for a local syndicate, slapping around lazy Polish hookers and knocking Turkish drug dealers' heads together for not making quota. He graduated to some low-level killings, gang versus gang stuff, nothing fancy.